Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, we're going to take a long view of the year 2020. We're going to summarize some of the top stories in science that have dominated the headlines that'll change our life in the year 2020. So what were the top 10 science stories? Well, let me summarize them really quick. The number one story, of course, is the pandemic, which has gripped the world. In fact, the leading cause of death in the United States is no longer heart disease or cancer. It is the coronavirus. And it's much more contagious than we originally thought. We now know that one person that attended a medical conference in Boston eventually infected 300,000 people around the world. And we know that by tracking the RNA and the genetic signature of that disease. Speaking of which, the second big story of 2020, biotechnology. In 1918, we knew nothing about these viruses. Now we know enough to be able to create a genetic map of the virus and therapeutics by which we can rein in some of the excesses of the virus. We now know that dexamethasone, monoclonal antibodies, remdesivir, they are some of the first things in our line of defense, therapeutics used against the coronavirus. And story number three, the vaccine is here. Already thousands of people are being inoculated with the vaccine, and the hope is that we'll reach what is called herd immunity. That is the point at which 60, maybe 70% of the population has antibodies against the virus, and then the virus will, quote, fade away. It will either disappear because so many people are inoculated, or it will mutate into another variety which is less dangerous and can still propagate. Believe it or not, the 1918 Spanish flu virus that killed more people than World War I, some scientists believe that it's still here. It didn't really, quote, fade away totally. Probably it just mutated to a form where it can still survive to infect people by being less vicious than before. Also, story number four of the top 10 stories of 2020, the crash, the collapse of one of our great instruments of science, the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico. If you saw the movies with James Bond and also the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, you know that the Arecibo radio telescope is a great prop for Hollywood movies, but also was the workhorse for radio telescope research, but it collapsed just last month. What a tremendous loss for science. And speaking about science, SpaceX and Elon Musk continue to make headlines. Not one, but two missions went up to the International Space Station. In fact, it was the first major public and private partnership, and we hope that'll reduce the cost of space travel. Not to mention the fact that new visions are being created for space travel. Back in the 1960s, there was a vision. Beat the Russians, beat the Russians, beat the Russians. Well, we beat the Russians, and that took the wind out of the sails of the space program, which pretty much collapsed in terms of funding over several decades. But now a new vision is emerging from Silicon Valley billionaires. Elon Musk wants to create a multi-planet species so that we don't go the way of the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs did not have a space program, and that's why they're not here today. And the richest man in the world, Elon Musk's rival, and that is Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, he also has a vision for Blue Origin's rocket program, and that is to create the Earth as a celestial garden. With all the polluting heavy industries done in outer space, the Earth is free of pollution and becomes a celestial jewel in the heavens. Speaking of which, Mars is in the news. Not one, not two, but three space probes were launched toward Mars. And in February, all three should be reaching the red planet. in preparation for a manned mission to Mars sometime after 2030. And story number 7, quantum computers. A new generation of computers have now surpassed supercomputers in terms of certain mathematical problems. This is called quantum supremacy, the point at which quantum computers can beat conventional computers on certain tasks. So we'll talk about that. The CIA, of course, is very much interested in this because with a quantum computer, you can crack any known code on the planet Earth. And speaking about the planets, story number 8, phosphine was discovered on Venus. We once thought that Venus was a hellhole, the evil twin of the Earth, temperatures soaring beyond 900 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than a baker's oven. But phosphine is a chemical found in organic processes, so maybe we shouldn't write Venus off the map. And water has been found on the moon. Not a lot of it, but enough water to be used for astronauts in the future. Perhaps water could be used to be purified for drinking purposes. It could be split apart. Hydrogen can be used for rocket fuel, oxygen for breathing with the water found on the moon. And story number 10, the Space Force now exists. President Donald Trump, in the waning days of his administration, signed a new declaration creating a new Space Force. And the question is, who benefits? Who loses? How dangerous? And is it really a peacekeeper in outer space? Well, let's just jump right now into the top stories, therefore, of 2020. The number one story that has dominated the headlines since February is the global pandemic. And why should we worry about it? Because 60% or so of all diseases come from the animal kingdom. That's right. The flu, for example, comes from aquatic birds and pigs. We know how these diseases are transmitted, and they originate in animals because A, they're more animals than humans. B, they've been around a lot longer than we have. And this means, therefore, that it's going to happen again. Another pandemic, like the pandemic of 1918, which killed more people than World War I. Now, this virus, the coronavirus, is more contagious and deadly than the flu, about 10 times more deadly than the flu, and much more contagious. In fact, by looking at the DNA and the RNA and the genetic signature of diseases, we can create a family tree so that we know where it came from and where it's going and where it mutated. Well, all the genetics point to the fact that the coronavirus, started in Wuhan, China, spread rapidly to Europe, especially Italy, and from there came to the United States, mainly through New York and Boston. In fact, we now know that about 60% of all people infected with the virus in the Northeast of America came from JFK Airport and Newark Airport. That's right, the airports of Europe came and infected the airports of the United States, which then infected the United States itself. There was a conference called in Boston. One person had the virus. He in turn spread it to the conference, and the conference delegates in turn spread it around the world. We now know that 300,000 people were infected because of one person at that Boston conference. And we know this by tracking down the genetics of the virus that has infected these 300,000 people. And so science is now involved, and scientists ask the question, what is the single most important thing that you should change in your behavior? Washing your hands, wiping down everything you touch, putting on a mask, social distancing. The number one activity that spreads the virus is social distancing. Yes, masks are important, but masks are not decisive. Yes, you can wash down everything with alcohol, but it really spreads through airborne transmission close contact with other infected people over a long period of time. That is the single most important way in which the virus spreads. Story number two, biotechnology has come not to the rescue, but has come to lessen the impact of the virus. Back in 1918, we knew nothing about this killer virus, the Spanish flu virus. Now we've genetically sequenced the virus and therapeutics have now been created. For example, we now know that the virus itself does not really kill you. Most of the deaths from the virus comes from overkill. That is, the virus overstimulates the human immune system, and the humans, as a consequence, literally drown in our own fluids. We drown in our own antibodies because the human body goes into overkill mode because of the presence of the coronavirus. But antibodies can be injected directly into the human from other humans that have recovered from the coronavirus, and you can also clone these antibodies. This gives us yet another therapeutic against the virus, monoclonal antibodies. They were, in fact, given to President Donald Trump when he got infected, and we think that it is one way to establish a bulwark against the virus, that is to inject antibodies that were cloned in the laboratory. So there is some hope there because we now know basically how the virus kills. Again, the virus does not kill directly for the most part. In its last stages, it creates a storm which then overwhelms many of our body's defenses because the body overreacts. And with monoclonal antibodies, with dexamethasone, with remdesivir, we have at least some way of reducing the impact of the virus. But of course, the real way to control the virus is with vaccination. And again, this is where biotechnology comes in. Usually it takes 5+ years to even get a vaccine out of the door, let alone distributed around the country. And this was done in record time, in just a matter of months. And how do they work? Well, if you've seen pictures of the coronavirus, you know that it has spikes coming out. These are called spike proteins, and they're like keys. Keys that then attach themselves to the cells of your lung, unlock the gate, and allow genetic material to flood into your lungs. And your lungs then create copies of the killer virus, which then escape to then kill you. That's how it works. But these vaccines, what these vaccines do is they try to neutralize the spike proteins so that the virus cannot replicate. And it does that with antibodies. And so the vaccination program is well underway. Right now we have not one, but two, eventually three therapeutics that are administered via vaccination. And yes, they work. 95% of the time they work. Now, does that mean that this is the end of the crisis? No. Because, well, first of all, there are some side effects. People have to be on the lookout for side effects. So that's why when you get inoculated, you have to sit. Sit for about 10, 15 minutes to see whether or not you're going to have a bad reaction to the virus. And then, of course, it's only 95% effective. 5% of the time, somebody could still get the virus. And we don't know how long the defense is going to last. We've only tested it for 3 months, for God's sake. So we simply don't know how long this will last. But at least you have to have two shots. And some people think that maybe, just maybe, the immunity could last for years. But we simply don't know for sure. But once we hit herd immunity, then this virus will be somewhat like the 1918 flu virus. That is, it will either have to go extinct or it will have to mutate to a milder form in order to keep on infecting people, which is what we think happened to the Spanish flu virus of 1918. Well, story number four. If you're a fan of science fiction or science in general, you know about the Arecibo Radio Telescope. It's a gigantic dish in the mountains of Puerto Rico. I had the luxury of visiting the Arecibo Radio Telescope, and it was a marvelous wonder. You go up an elevator, you go down the shaft to this gigantic observation deck where you can see this huge dish aimed at outer space. It's the workhorse of radio telescope technology, featured in James Bond movies, in the movie Contact. And, well, sad to say, last month, one cable broke, then a second cable broke, and then the whole thing came crashing down. And at the present time, there's simply not enough funds to repair that radio telescope. So it's not clear what's going to happen, but it is a setback for science because of the fact that the Arecibo Radio Telescope was used for many purposes. For example, tracking killer asteroids, trying to see whether or not there are intelligent signals from aliens in outer space, the SETI project, looking for exoplanets orbiting other star systems. So these are things that the Arecibo Radio Telescope pioneered, but unfortunately, it collapsed. However, story number five, SpaceX is once again at the forefront of space exploration. You know, NASA has done a great job exploring the universe with a limited budget, but when it comes to a piloted mission to explore outer space, NASA has been criticized as being, quote, the agency to nowhere. I mean, it doesn't go anywhere in terms of exploring the planets. And this is changing because of an influx of big bucks from Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley billionaires are now opening up their checkbooks to underwrite programs with the government to explore the moon, explore Mars, and to have a new vision for the space program. You know, back in 1966, at the height of the Apollo space program, the Apollo space program consumed 5% of the U.S. federal budget. Let me repeat that again. 5% of every dollar you spent in taxes to the government went to the Apollo space program. That was unsustainable. And sure enough, a few years later, it collapsed in terms of funding. It was simply too expensive, especially when we beat the Russians. There was no more wind in the sails of the space program. Well, now we have a new wind. We're entering the second era of the exploration of outer space. Silicon Valley billionaires are leading the way, believe it or not, opening up their checkbooks, pioneering things like reusable rockets. Rockets that only cost a fraction of the cost of a traditional rocket. NASA, for example, is pioneering the SLS booster rocket. Many people think that's the old-fashioned NASA, NASA where budgets didn't make any difference. And it's estimated that each launch will cost about $1 billion for just one launch of the SLS booster rocket put forth by Boeing and NASA. Some people think that it may never fly. It's simply too expensive. Here comes SpaceX, coming in with a stripped-down program with the Falcon Heavy, capable of launching satellites into outer space with reusable rockets, dropping down the cost, perhaps as low as 10% of the cost of conventional rockets. And so SpaceX made history by having not one, but two of its rockets send astronauts to the space station. Because before then, we were hitchhiking on the Russians. Who would have thought that for all the billions of dollars spent to beat the Russians, that we would pay them to put our astronauts in outer space? That's kind of humiliating. But yes, that's the way it went. And story number six, on to the red planet, on to planet Mars. Come February, not one, not two, but three space probes will be converging on the red planet, launched just a few months ago in 2020. They are probes from the United Arab Emirates, making its first entree into interplanetary exploration, the Chinese, and also the United States, in preparation for an eventual manned mission to the red planet sometime after 2030. Also making the headlines, quantum computers. You know, it was the space program that gave us the microchip because we had to miniaturize computers to put them on space probes. We had to miniaturize computers so they created the microchip, which then fueled much of the world's prosperity in the decades since. Well, now we're running out of Moore's Law. Moore's Law said the computer power doubles every 18 months, and that's what the reason why we have this super powerful infrastructure of computers that give us our standard of living, our way of life, energizing the economy. But it can't last. Your Pentium chip has a layer about 20 atoms across at minimum. In the coming years, it'll be perhaps 5 atoms across. At that point, the quantum principle takes over. You don't know where the electron is anymore. It leaks out. Plus, you have enormous heat generation, and the whole thing collapses. In other words, Moore's Law, the engine behind world prosperity for the last several decades, will come to a close. The age of silicon will end, and a new age will dawn, perhaps the coming of quantum computers. Computers that compute on individual atoms rather than molecules of silicon. And just this month, the Chinese set a new record with a different kind of quantum computer called a photon quantum computer that computes on light beams. They were able to make a quantum computer perhaps billions of times more powerful than our supercomputer. And before that, Google went into the race for a quantum computer. It debuted its superconducting quantum computer, which also broke the limit for computation for a supercomputer. So are we about to enter the new age of quantum computation? Well, not so fast. First of all, even the CIA, we now realize, investigated the potential of quantum computers, and it said, yes, eventually, quantum computers will be able to break any known code on the planet Earth. But there's a catch. There's always a catch someplace. Quantum computers are not ready yet. In other words, the slightest vibration, the slightest jiggle, someone coughing many, many, many miles away could, in principle, damage the vibrations of these atoms, causing chaos, ruining the calculation. Also, these calculations done by Google and by the Chinese, yes, they did break speed records, but they are one-trick ponies. That is, that's all they can do. It's like a chess-playing machine. You can't talk to it. You can't have it do your income tax. No, a chess-playing machine, all it can do is play chess. So, in other words, we are making the first inroads into quantum computation, which could be the future. The problem is, it's not ready for prime time. So, when will it be ready for prime time? We're not sure, but maybe in the next few decades, quantum computers will change everything. And also, speaking about the space program once again, Venus, Mars, they've all been factored in because new breakthroughs are being made into determining what it's like to be on the moon and on Venus. First of all, water has been detected on the moon in the form of ice crystals. That's very important because water is more precious than gold or oil on the moon. We need water because first it can be purified for drinking purposes for our astronauts. Second of all, the hydrogen of water can be used for rocket fuel. And the oxygen can be used for breathing purposes. And then Venus is also in the news. It turns out that Venus was once upon a time thought to be a hellhole, the evil twin of the Earth. It's almost exactly the same size of the Earth, except it's much closer to the sun than the Earth. Its carbon dioxide atmosphere captures sunlight, creating a runaway greenhouse effect, soaring temperatures to 900 degrees that is hotter than a baker's oven. On Venus, you'd be crushed by the fact that the atmosphere is 100 times denser than the Earth. You'd be fried to bits with a temperature exceeding 900 degrees. And when it rains sulfuric acid. So whatever is left of you walking on the surface of Venus would be crushed into a powder. That's how inhospitable the surface of Venus is. But the atmosphere cools as you leave Venus, and it eventually reaches ordinary temperatures, and phosphine, A chemical found in organic processes has also been found in the atmosphere of Venus. So in other words, maybe the Venusians don't land and work on the surface of Venus. Maybe the Venusians work in the atmosphere of Venus. And speaking about the exploration of outer space, story number 10, the Trump administration has made it official in 2020, a Space Force, just like the Air Force or the Navy or the Army, a Space Force to keep the peace in outer space, they say. Well, there are pluses and minuses. Everyone realizes the fact that much of our economy is done in outer space. In fact, the United States controls, directly or indirectly, over half of the satellites in outer space. On one hand, well, we have to protect them. And so the proponents of the Space Force say, what's wrong with being the cop on the block? Because most of the satellites are our satellites. Well, yeah, but then the opposite point of view is, precisely because most of the satellites up there in outer space are our satellites, we're more vulnerable if a war breaks out. I mean, even a small country like North Korea could, in principle, shoot a keg of nails, just dynamite with nails, and wipe out a good fraction of our satellites. Or they could simply detonate an atomic bomb, initiate an electromagnetic pulse, which would then destabilize and ruin almost half of our satellites in outer space. Now, the Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your own feet. There is a danger there that if outer space gets militarized, because other countries want to match the United States tit for tat, if outer space gets militarized, who suffers the most if there's a war in outer space? It is us. We are very much dependent upon these satellites. Our economy is glued to these satellites. We would be the ones suffering the most. What's the solution? Some people say the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. That's right. In the early days of the space race, the United States, Russia, many countries signed the Outer Space Treaty, stating two things. One, space should not be nuclearized with nuclear weapons. And two, no nation can claim a celestial body like the moon as its own. Well, that has held the peace, believe it or not, for so many decades, but it is woefully out of date. Think back to what we had back in 1967, and think of what we have today. We have satellites everywhere you look in outer space. So some people think that may be a solution, a new outer space treaty. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College of New York. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to soar into outer space with an astronaut, Tom Jones, somebody who has been in outer space with the space station. And as you know, we're going back into space now. Prices are dropping. New funds are coming in. New visions are being proposed by scientists from Silicon Valley, of all places. And so in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about what it would be like to explore the universe. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College of New York. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to soar into outer space with an astronaut, Tom Jones, somebody who has been in outer space with the space station. And as you know, we're going back into space now. Prices are dropping. New funds are coming in. New visions are being proposed by scientists from Silicon Valley, of all places. And so in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about what it would be like to explore the universe. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we summarize some of the top 10 stories of 2020. Most of it, of course, bad news concerning the coronavirus, but some good news from science, because we learned so much about the genetics, the spread, the mechanisms by which this virus paralyzed human society. And with 60% of all diseases approximately coming from the animal kingdom, you know it's going to happen again. But next time, we're going to be prepared. We're going to have an early warning system. We're going to know exactly what to do in case the next pandemic jumps out from the animal kingdom. Well, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the space program. One of the pieces of good news from 2020 is the further exploration of outer space. For the first time in many years, the United States is once again fielding its own astronauts to the space station. However, we have to also realize that President Donald Trump wants to create a space force similar to the Air Force, similar to the Army. Some people say, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, after all, the Russians, the Chinese, they have their equivalent. So what's wrong with us being, quote, the cop on the block? Well, yes, there's a certain argument that says that. We don't want chaos there in outer space. However, I think what we really need is an outer space treaty, like the one signed in 1967, that has held the peace for many a decade. The Outer Space Treaty, again, says simply that nuclear weapons should be banned from outer space, and the nations should not declare celestial bodies as part of their property. But that was 1967. We've progressed so far from then. For example, weapons today don't have to be nuclear at all. Conventional weapons in outer space are powerful enough to cause tremendous havoc. And because the United States controls over 50% of the satellites in outer space, we would be the big victims. But anyway, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the peaceful exploration of space. Our special guest is Tom Jones, an astronaut for NASA, and he's going to talk to us about the training and the psychology of the astronauts brave enough to go into outer space to explore the universe. So once again, with us today is astronaut Tom Jones. I should also point out that if you want to know more about Exploration and what I do, go to my website. My website is mkaku.org, mkaku.org. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers. My latest bestseller is called The Future of Humanity, talking about our humanity in outer space. One day we're going to go back to the moon, maybe even terraform Mars and go beyond to explore the universe. And you can also follow me on Facebook. In fact, I have 4 million fans on Facebook. So once again, let's get to our interview with Tom Jones, astronaut for NASA. The first question for you, Dr. Jones, is, as a youth, how did you first get interested in exploration and the space program?
It's easy to remember for me. My grandmother was a big reader, and so she went down to the 5-and-dime store and bought on the remnant table a book called Spaceflight, The Coming Exploration of the Universe. It was one of these little golden books of knowledge that you could get back in the 1960s. And so I was 5, and she gave me this book, and it was filled with wonderful illustrations, paintings of what spaceflight might be like. There were no photos because no one had gone into space yet. But that really captured my imagination. These astronauts and spaceships were fascinating subjects to me. So I began to read more about those on trips to the library, and very quickly got fascinated with the subject of space science and astronomy. When I was 12, my parents got our family our first telescope, and I became the sole operator of it. it was tough to get other people to let other people use it, but I had it out a lot in suburban Baltimore. And along with the fact that they were building rockets in my hometown as part of the Gemini program in the middle 60s, I think all of these things combined to make astronautics and astronomy a very favorite subject of mine, which I just devoured in school and at the library.
And you went to the United States Air Force Academy. Why'd you go there, and did you have in the back of your mind this career path that would take you into outer space?
Well, certainly by the age of 10, I was aware of the job of astronaut, and the fact that it was a reality and that they were building rockets in my hometown. And I said, well, I'd like to ride a machine like that someday. And during the Apollo program, as we watched the first run-ups to the moon landings, I was aware that test pilots were the ones who were selected to be astronauts. So if I wanted to do the job, I certainly had to become a test pilot. And you've got to go through a military flight training program. And I chose the Air Force. So the Air Force Academy seemed to me the best place that was focused on flying in the country. And that's why I tried to enroll there. By the time I was in college, the moon landings were just finishing. And so it was very clear that I still wanted to do this, and I thought that was a great jump on the program, getting into flight school, becoming an Air Force pilot, and then becoming a test pilot.
And I understand that you flew missions on B-52 bombers for the Strategic Air Command. Could you elaborate?
Well, after a year of pilot training after graduation, I got a basic science degree at the Air Force Academy. I knew I was going to be flying for a while and then try to get into test pilot school. So my first assignment after pilot training was to go to Strategic Air Command, which was an outfit that was involved in nuclear deterrence. And my mission as a B-52 crew member, a co-pilot, and then an aircraft commander, was to sit alert duty out at the base about once every 3 weeks. I would live for an entire week out of the base trying to make sure that the Russians would always fear a counterattack if they tried to do a surprise attack on the U.S. So we trained for the nuclear delivery mission, a doomsday mission. And it was quite a strange existence. Every third week, you'd be waiting for the horn to blow, signaling a Russian attack, and then you'd jump into your planes and taxi out as fast as you could and take off. That's what we trained for. And fortunately, nobody ever shot at me, and the Cold War wound down to its eventual conclusion. While I was doing that, though, NASA brought along the space shuttle and changed the rules on how you could become an astronaut.
Now, many people who watched the movie, Top Gun with Tom Cruise, have dreamed about dogfights up there in the wild blue yonder. However, you went for a PhD in planetary sciences. So how did that come about?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was in the Air Force and sitting alert duty, and I remember clearly being out there on the base during one of those weeks of duty and watching the miniseries Cosmos by Carl Sagan. And this was a man and a television production that really captured my imagination, and I said, here's a guy who's doing this for a career, the thing that I've loved to study and read about all these years, and now that NASA is looking for scientists and engineers, maybe I can become a space scientist, and maybe that would be an alternate path. I knew that test piloting would be a tough assignment to get. It was very competitive in the Air Force, and especially for bomber pilots who weren't widely needed at that time. So after watching Cosmos and reading some more books about that particular profession, I decided I'd go back to graduate school and see if I could become a practicing research scientist.
Now, a lot of people ask the question, if I want to become an astronaut, what do I do? Do I send a postcard to NASA saying, sign me up? What is the career path? What is the process by which somebody out there can realize a dream of going into outer space?
Well, it's easier today with the Internet. You can get on the Internet and read all about astronaut selection at NASA.gov, NASA.gov, their website, and search for astronaut selection. But back then, you just wrote a letter to the Johnson Space Center in Houston where the astronauts train, and I got a reply back from the selection office, and they informed me about the basic qualifications. You have to send in an application, which includes a big civil service exam and a lot of paperwork to fill out, as well as a medical exam. And you just send in that application, they keep it on file, and then every time that they select a new group of astronauts, they'll notify you to see whether you're still interested in applying. And so I started that process in 1986.
Now, 1986 was also a watershed year because that's when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up on international television, a very sobering event. Seven astronauts tragically lost their lives in that accident. And we sometimes forget that going into outer space is not a Sunday picnic, that about 1% of the time, there is booster rocket failure and major malfunction of rockets. So was that sobering? How did that impact on you?
Oh, it was terrible. I was watching that accident. I was watching with the launch of that mission with Krista McAuliffe, the first school teacher to go into space, with a bunch of school students, elementary school students at the University of Arizona, where I was a graduate student. And the catastrophe unfolded before us on this big screen TV. And, you know, you had to try to make some sense of it for the kids and tell the kids that there was no hope that they had gotten out. And it was a terrible emotional blow. Next door at the Lunar and Planetary Lab where I was studying, everyone was completely floored devastated by this emotionally, even though most of the people were involved in planetary science and astronomy and robotic missions. They knew how serious this was for the future of space travel and exploration in general. So it was a real body blow. I had met the commander of that mission about a year before, and he'd encouraged me to apply to become an astronaut. He was a very motivated guy who was clear about his mission, and it was infectious. It motivated me to follow in his footsteps. And after his death, Dick Scobee, I decided that, well, he must have really believed in this to risk his life in such a way. And I knew that my desire to do it was very strong. And I thought if people like that I look up to are willing to risk their lives, then I still think I could find the courage to do the same thing. And I talked it over with my wife before I began applying.
Now, you're a former test pilot, and you know when you go into that cockpit that you're putting your life on the line. You know that unlike a civilian, which wants lots of life insurance and assurances, there's no problem. You know you're putting your life on the line when you go into a jet airplane. Now, when you become an astronaut, are the astronauts also told the same thing? We have civilians going into outer space. We have politicians and multimillionaires now going into outer space. Are they really mentally prepared for the fact that, well, like I mentioned, roughly 1% of the time there is catastrophic failure?
Well, we're certainly aware of the risks. As a pilot, I didn't become a test pilot. I actually left the Air Force after just flying bombers because I wanted to pursue this science path. But I knew that the professionals involved in flying the shuttle were aware of the risks. Of course, Scobee certainly was. And I decided that there must be a recognition among all the crew members that what they're doing must register on them as being so worthwhile that they're willing to risk their physical safety, even their lives, to accomplish these missions. And when I got into the Astronaut Corps in 1990, I found that to be true, that people were thinking of this as a long-term program of exploration. They figured that the benefits they'd bring back from each mission would be building blocks that future explorers would use to return to the moon, get to the asteroids and Mars. So we all viewed this as a continuum, and each little contribution that we made was worth the risk of our lives. Now, the shuttle's a pretty safe machine, even though it's had two terrible accidents. It's one of the most reliable rockets that's out there. So you can always tell yourself that it's not going to happen to you, but you must recognize that it's a finite possibility that each mission's got, you know, one in a couple of hundred chances of leading to a catastrophe.
Okay, now let's get into the guts of your book. That is the training of an astronaut and what it's like there to orbit the Earth and look down from outer space. First of all, the training. Let's talk about going into swimming pools, going into 1,000 horsepower centrifuges, going into the Vomit Comet. What is the grueling regimen that astronaut training entails?
Well, to begin with, it's much like a college curriculum of investigating the basics of spaceflight. So you bring in all these people who are test pilots and scientists and engineers, and they have varied backgrounds, but everyone's capable of learning. And so essentially it's a graduate course in spaceflight and its fundamentals and the systems that allow us to survive and work up there, the space shuttle in this case. So it's a year of astronaut basic training. And you start in a classroom, read a lot of books, get a lot of lectures. So that's very familiar to most of us. And yet it moves very quickly into simulator training, where you're actually flipping switches, reading checklists, working as a team to put into practice what you've learned in the classroom. And there are also a lot of ancillary training experiences that are quite fun, even though they're very serious in mind, like survival training. What do you do if you bail out of a jet or out of the shuttle and you come down in some distant location where you've got to await rescue? So we had water and land survival training. We also, as you say, rode the centrifuge to prepare us for the accelerations of launch, scuba training to prepare us for underwater training in a spacesuit to simulate free fall, and finally that ride on the Vomit Comet that everybody looks forward to, where you get 20-second doses of free fall as the airplane rides this roller coaster path through the sky. And that's both exuberant and exhilarating, and then finally in the end it's an endurance contest to see if you can keep your stomach and your mind together while this airplane does these gyrations. But it's great to experience free fall.
Now, people who saw the movie Apollo 13 saw Tom Hanks floating for what seemed like forever. And people said, well, how'd they do that? There's no room for wires in that tiny little capsule. How'd they get Tom Hanks to float like that? And as you mentioned, it was this airplane called the Vomit Comet. And there's a reason for that. People throw up. Is that right?
Well, some do. Most people get a little queasy after the end of an hour and a half on that plane, where you do 40 up and down roller coaster cycles to give you those cycles of weightlessness that last 20 or 25 seconds. It's very aggravating to be in free fall for 25 seconds and then be slammed to the floor with 2 times the force of gravity as you pull out. And when you do that over and over, it tends to tumble your gyros and lead to nausea. I found that I never really got aggressively sick up there, but I certainly felt after the end of those 40 parabolas that I was ready to walk wobbly off the airplane and go sit down quietly for a while.
And let's talk about weightlessness. Weightlessness is the state of free fall. That is, if you're in an elevator and someone cuts the wire of the elevator, God forbid, you are in free fall and you are weightless because the floor of the elevator falls at the same rate that you do, giving you the illusion that there's no gravity. Of course, there's gravity. It's pulling you to the floor, but the floor is falling at the same rate as you. Same thing with the Vomit Comet. You're essentially being hurled like a rock into the atmosphere, and you are in free fall. So the question is, if you're in free fall, that sensation is a sensation of dying. That is, you're falling off a skyscraper. So is that the sensation that you have, that you're thrown like a rock into the atmosphere in the Vomit Comet? Is a sensation like the sensation that you're dying?
Well, fortunately, your body is pretty easily fooled. Your mind is fooled because you're in a cabin of an aircraft or you're in the cabin of a space shuttle, and you can't tell that you're being hurtled through the atmosphere or around the planet at hundreds or thousands of miles per hour as you fall, either on this roller coaster parabola or, you know, in an orbit around the Earth. So to you, your surroundings are falling with you. They all appear motionless. That's your frame of reference. And so you just appear to be floating. And so it's rather a gentle feeling. You don't feel any motion of high speed or even standing on the edge of a precipice and leaping off. So it's pretty easy to get used to. It's just a gentle lifting or a floating feeling, and it's nice to be able to move with just a fingertip push against the walls. And I find it's something that you actually forget about after a couple of days.
Now, you spent 52 days in Earth orbit during the 11 years you were in the astronaut program. So everyone wants to know, if you're up there for not just 20 seconds, but for days on end, how do you do very simple bodily functions, like, for example, eating? How do you eat when your food floats in front of you? How do you drink if water will simply float to the ceiling? And what the question everyone wants to know is, how do you go to the bathroom?
Well, all of those subjects I try to explore in skywalking to give you that personal experience of being in there. Eating, fortunately, is almost a non-issue. All of your swallowing and digestive functions seem to work just fine with the peristalsis that moves things through your digestive tract at work. Doesn't need gravity to function. You do have to eat these foods out of a pouch and drink liquids from a pouch with a straw inserted so that food and debris and globules of liquid don't float around the cabin and mess up the systems up there. So it's rather tedious after a while that you have to eat one package at a time. You don't get to sample 3 or 4 dishes at once. You've got to eat in a serial fashion, and it almost becomes perfunctory after a week of the novelty wearing off. So, but it's aside from a little bit of extra time and care required, it's actually quite easy to eat and drink. And I still enjoy the varied menu that we had available to us. Even though the foods aren't fresh, they're at least freeze-dried or irradiated or thermostabilized, so they retain some good flavors. Now, the bathroom question, down here on the ground, gravity makes everything go where it's supposed to. And as I write in the pages of Skywalking up there, you've got some special training to use because we use air instead of gravity to make things go where they're supposed to. Liquid down a suction hose where each crew member uses a personal funnel to guide the liquid into the tube. And for solid waste, it's blown into a storage tank underneath the commode seat. And then the clever thing about it is that the solid waste tank, while it's not in use, is exposed to a vacuum. So the solid waste is sterilized and dehydrated. So the next time it's used, there's no odor or chance of a pathogen getting back into the cabin. It's quite clever. And while it takes longer to use the system than on Earth, it actually functions quite well.
Well, according to the book, The Right Stuff, by Tom Wolfe, when our first astronaut, Alan Shepard, was sent into a suborbital trajectory, he had to go to the bathroom. He told Mission Control he had to go to the bathroom, and Mission Control vetoed it. And so they sent him into outer space, where he essentially urinated in outer space. Now, that is not a good thing to do, right? Because if you have liquid inside your spacesuit and you are weightless, it could be a mess, right?
Well, it certainly was a mess, and I'm sure he was a quite a smelly guy when he came back and got out of the suit. But he survived just fine, and that's because of spacesuit design. They don't put any electronics generally inside an oxygen-filled suit unless there be an ignition source that could lead to a fire. So the inside of a spacesuit tends to be a quite benign place, and the liquid was just a little bit of mess. Fortunately, on the space shuttle, we deal with free fall inside a spacesuit by using diapers, large, absorbent, adult-sized diapers that can take care of that eventuality. And, you know, the space shuttle itself, you know, provides a means to get out of the suit right after you arrive in orbit, and you don't have to put the suit back on until reentry. So then you can use the bathroom facilities that we just discussed. So we're a long way from the right stuff now, and people seem to be able to deal with this quite easily.
Okay. Now, what is it like spiritually and emotionally to be in orbit, to look down on the planet Earth as you are in a spacewalk, suspended, orbiting the Earth, suspended in mid-flight with this little cable that connects you to the mother craft? What is it like to look back at the Earth?
Well, Michio, this was a great experience. I had been dreaming about spaceflight since I was 10. And here I was, 39 years old, on my first mission. And as I write in Skywalking, I got to orbit. I was so busy with my initial jobs that it was about an hour before I actually had a moment to look out the window. And I'll never forget that first impression of the Earth. I was looking out on the night side of Earth, and instead of stars, I saw this big round space or gap where stars should have been. That was the dark side of our planet. But on the very edge, the limb of the Earth, was a gentle band of robin's egg blue light that was growing in intensity and widening along the horizon of the Earth, and that was the coming sunrise. And this beautiful, delicate blue, and the fact that I was finally looking back at my planet after waiting for almost three decades to get there, brought tears to my eyes with the realization that I had finally arrived at that moment in time and space. And, you know, they were tears of gratitude to God for sending me up there and giving me the chance to do this, and they were just tears of appreciation at the beauty that I was seeing. And throughout my experiences in space on the other three missions I flew, the view of the Earth never became boring, or I never became blasé about it. It was always riveting. I had to tear myself away from the windows to go to work because it's always such a lovely sight and so attractive to a human being to gaze on our own world.
And do you also get a sense of the fragility of life? First of all, the atmosphere is extremely thin, and yet it's like the skin of an apple, and yet it creates life on the planet Earth. Not to mention the fact that the Earth is suspended in this rather hostile environment of cosmic rays and potential meteor impacts. So do you get a feeling of the fragility of humanity, that we are, quote-unquote, on spaceship Earth?
You certainly get a sense that the Earth is a varied and delicate place. You see immense variety in color and in texture as you travel around the planet once every 90 minutes. Looking at the Earth's horizon, you can see this thin blanket of the atmosphere. You can look down at night and watch meteors burning up in it below you, and you can see the airglow layer high in the atmosphere against the dark night full of stars. So it's aesthetically beautiful, and you're aware of how thin that envelope of air is in particular. I found that you wanted to get to these thousands of places on Earth that you could see, that the rainforest, the glaciers, the high mountain peaks, the river valleys. You wanted to go personally to all of these places to learn more about the planet, and yet you realize as a human being you're never going to live long enough to go to all of these places that you've seen from orbit. I felt a great attraction and sense of longing in my heart to be part of Earth, and I felt separated from it to some extent, especially thinking that I was half a world away from my family most of the time. But generally, I had this great attraction for this lovely planet of ours, and I can't imagine what the Apollo astronauts must have experienced traveling 1,000 miles farther away in space than I did. And it was so strong for me, I'm sure that they must have had a great longing to get back.
Okay, now let's talk about the downside of being in outer space. For example, the Russians set the world's record for being in outer space on one mission, being lofted into space for over a year. And when that cosmonaut came back down to Earth, he could barely crawl. He was almost like a worm. The atrophy of the muscles was so great that he could not stand up. And so let's talk about the fact that when you're in space, you have enormous muscle and bone loss.
Short-term space flight doesn't present many problems. We exercised every couple of days while we were in space. The longest trip I had was 18 days. And so if you do a medium amount of exercise for an hour every other day, you're going to keep your heart, lungs, and muscles in good enough shape to do any physical task that's required and also to withstand reentry. And then you can sort of stagger off the space shuttle and get your land legs under you just as you were coming back from a long sea voyage. And within about a half an hour, you can walk under your own steam with no great worries. You feel heavy at first when you come back to Earth. That passes in about an hour. The longest effect that I felt was about 3 days of lacking a fine sense of motor balance. So I couldn't bend over from the waist and pick up a penny on the floor. That would have just toppled me over. I had to wait until my brain became used to using those inner ear balance organs again, and it took about 3 days for those to come back online. Now, for space station astronauts, like my friend Bill MacArthur, who's headed back to Earth on April 8th here, he's been up there for more than 6 months, and he's been exercising every day for 90 minutes. He's been using both a treadmill and an exercise bike and a resistive exercise device that allows him to do the equivalent of lifting weights up there. And by combining those forms of exercise, his muscle and cardiac health will be in pretty good shape when he comes home. So I think he'll be able to walk within about an hour. He's got the benefit of a lot of experience since that Russian mission 16 or 17 years ago. He'll be able to be more mobile when he comes back. He will have, however, some loss of calcium from his skeleton. He's lost some bone mass. Some of that will recover back on Earth. He'll probably have a permanent deficit of a few percent. And, of course, we don't know the long-term repercussions of that. So while he's going to get some professional physical rehabilitation, I think he'll have no short-term ill effects, and it'll only be in the later decades of his life that he finds out whether he's got skeletal weakening that's of any consequence. It doesn't appear to be a long-term effect for these six-month space station missions. But as you understand, Mars missions are an open question.
And as you know, once again, a mission to Mars is not a cakewalk. Only 3 days to go from the Earth to the Moon. That's a hop, skip, and a jump. To go to Mars, from the Earth to Mars, takes 9 months at the minimum. And then you have to wait a few months for the planets to align correctly for the return trip, and another 9 months to come back. So in other words, minimum a 2-year trip to the Moon. And then, as we mentioned in the past, the world's record for being in outer space is only a little bit more than just 1 year. And we're still learning the effects of radiation, long-term weightlessness, muscle degradation, and all the metabolic changes that take place when you go into outer space for long periods of time. Well, unfortunately, I'm afraid that's it for exploration. Once again, our special guest was Tom Jones, astronaut from NASA. And this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program or find out more about my work, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And I've written 4 bestsellers that hit the New York Times bestseller list. The latest one is called The Future of Humanity, about our future in outer space. So once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. Good day.